Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 13th, 2005. Today's session, Family, Faith, Community, and Stewardship, presented by John DeGroff in the Fireside Room. Disc number DEJ-2005-02. Let's listen in.
Some of you were probably at the last session. We may repeat a tiny bit from that, but if the recording wants to start, feel free to do so. I'm John DeGraff. I think many of you I've seen from the previous classes. So, and I have a confession to make to start this particular session, which is that if it's true that we teach what we need to learn, I think that I'm a case study in everything that I criticize in many cases, but I am trying. So I want to hereby acknowledge my guilt and tell you that I've started another organization. Pardon me for any of those who've heard this one before, but it's called AHA, A-H-A, that stands for the American Hypocrites Association. It's for all of us who are overworking to end overwork or overdoing anything to end something so related. I hope that my personal imperfections will not detract from the conversation that we're going to have. I was very saddened this week to hear when I arrived at Holden that Dorothy Bass has been away for a couple of weeks with pneumonia. And I'm sad for two reasons. I mean, that Dorothy got pneumonia, but also because I was really hoping to have her share in some of what I was doing here, because she's really spent a lot of time and effort on these issues, and particularly from a Lutheran and from a religious Christian perspective. I just want to suggest for anyone who isn't familiar with her book, Receiving the Day, to check it out. It's Christian Practices for Opening the Gift of Time. And the way Dorothy starts the book is that she talks about the fact that in her town in Indiana, she teaches at Valparaiso, and in her town, all the children are required to buy date books at the beginning of the fourth grade. I don't know if that's true in your town. It hasn't quite happened in mine yet, but sort of a shocking thing. But I think, needless to say, an awful lot of kids are carrying appointment calendars these days that have not that much white space. So Dorothy says, these days it can seem that time itself is out of kilter. Grave imbalances exist for almost everyone. Some people are vastly overworked and vastly overpaid. Others work too long and earn too little. And others work seldom, if at all. And however much or little we work, the time we do have is losing its shape as round-the-clock employment, shopping, and entertainment blur the boundaries between one season and another, between day and night. No wonder we turn to our date books in the hope that they can get us back in control. When we require them of fourth graders, what are we communicating to them about the society in which they live? Are we preparing them to enter an economy that intends to squeeze every minute out of them sooner or later? And I would suggest that the answer, at least right now in our society, is yes to that. I mentioned in the earlier class that some 20% of the school districts in America now have banned recess for elementary school kids on the grounds that those kids have to maximize their instruction time in order to be prepared to compete in this global economy. So this is spreading, and this idea that kids have to be scheduled like this, we've got to do more and more of this, and that seems to be the message. So when we think of the phrase, take off your shoes, of course, in the context that we understand it here with Moses, we're talking about respecting holy ground and the commandment from God. But in a more colloquial sense, what do we mean usually when we say, take off your shoes?
Relax,
relax, kick back, you know, take a rest. In the book of Mark, chapter 6, verses 30 and 31, we find the beginning of the story of the loaves and the fishes and the feeding of the multitudes. The apostles gathered around Jesus and told him all they had done and taught. And he said to them, "Come away to a deserted place all by yourself and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat." Coming and going, no leisure even to eat, not even a fast food place on the corner, I'm sure. Does this ring a bell to us in our modern world? Now, how important do you think Jesus must have thought that the work of the apostles was at that particular time? Very important, not so important. We can go on a scale from 1 to 5 if you want, but I mean, how important? Very, very important. And yet he told them, you've got to make this time. You've got to kick back. You've got to rest and take some leisure. In our society, how important is a lot of the work that we see people doing so much of? As important? Maybe not. But this is what we have become accustomed to in our society, so that we have essentially the longest working hours in the industrial world. We have become a society where work is really a kind of a 24/7 kind of thing, and where we overschedule what free time we do have and what time our children have, or if we don't do that, we collapse in front of the television set. And we talked a little bit about the impacts of this in the last conversation, the impacts of this schedule of overwork and frantic busyness all of the time. What I want to do for the next 5 minutes is just to quickly brainstorm and kind of run down the list of all of the things that you can think of, all of the impacts that you can think of. Many of them we did talk about in the last session, so you can just recall them quickly. But I want to make just a quick list here of what you think the impacts of working so much and being so busy are in the negative sense. So let's just call it out. You know, nobody needs to raise their hand or anything, but just call out what you see this doing to people.
Poor citizenship.
Okay. Keep hollering.
Ill health.
Stress.
Sleep deprivation.
Lack of family time.
Okay. Lack of family time.
Decreased relationships.
Family time and also friendship time, I guess. Relationships.
No time for God.
Ah, okay. No time for God.
Or art.
No time for God, no time for art.
No quiet time.
No quiet time.
No verbal history.
No verbal history? Explain that one just a little bit.
It's up here. Yeah, you know, where you sit around and tell stories of the past, of your family, your culture.
So we lose that whole sense of the, okay.
That's what history used to be.
So kind of no verbal tradition, no verbal history, okay?
Traffic jams.
Traffic jams.
And road rage.
And road rage. How many of you have experienced road rage and drivers kind of out of control?
Ourselves are in those other people.
don't you just want to shoot them? hooked that up with ill health. And how does that, what does that come from in terms of our, how is that connected to time pressure? Fast food?
Okay. Reliance on mechanized travel.
Yep.
Okay, that.
Gotta get there quicker, faster.
Okay.
No time for exercise.
No time for exercise.
Related to that, I think we lie to ourselves. We watch those TV shows and say, hey, you can get in shape in 5 minutes, just do this.
Okay.
We're living a lie.
Loss of truth? Is that it?
That's right.
Well, we're running out of room here. We're not only running out of time, we're running out of room. I'll try to put a few of them up above here. Because I think there are a few more.
No time to help your neighbor.
Oh, no time for neighbor. No time to help. No time to be friends. No time to help when people need help.
Forgetfulness.
Pardon?
Forgetfulness.
Forgetfulness? Where do we see that?
Not making all your appointments.
Yeah, missing appointments. Having all those. Anybody here ever have a whole lot of phone calls to make, and you make calls, and all of a sudden this thing happens that you call somebody and the phone rings and you forget who it was
you were
calling? This is like a really, really
embarrassing.
It happens to me, and I always feel really, really bad about this.
No time to volunteer.
Okay, no time to help, no time to volunteer.
Poor consuming habits.
Pardon?
Poor consumer habits.
Poor consumer habits.
Definitely.
How so?
Impulse buying.
Yeah.
How does this affect our consumer habits?
We buy lots to fill in.
Okay.
To meet needs and to also do things faster.
Don't plan what you're going to buy. How many of you try to shop for products that you know were made by workers who were paid decently or were made with taking the environment into account? How many of you, for example, if you can, if it's available, try to buy fair trade products? Quite a few. Good. I've noticed this, that just knowing about that stuff, I mean, it takes time to read the, you have all these labels on products, and, you know, nutrition this, and this, this, and this, and so much choice that we also have to kind of figure out. So, what about pets? Anybody seen an impact on pets?
Do I?
A lot of time at home alone. Yes.
Pet obesity.
Pet obesity too.
We're seeing a huge increase in behavioral problems in the pets. I'm a small animal pet.
Oh,
Prozac
for dogs, right?
Yeah, and 75% of the dogs in Seattle are obese. Nobody wants to believe it. They think I'm nuts. People with normal weight dogs bring them into the clinic to find out how much they should gain because they get so much grief walking green light with them. So pets are suffering.
Obese dogs on Prozac.
Well, and dogs don't drink because people don't have time.
That's the title of a book.
Yeah. Even a dog's life isn't what it used to be.
No.
Yeah. One of the things we see is that humane societies around the country are talking about an epidemic of pets being abandoned and left on their doorstep. The other thing we see is that in many cities in the United States, guess what the fastest growing business is?
Pet care.
Pet care or dog walkers. Right. Those kind of things. You take care of you see the people kind of coming down the street basically falling over or being pulled by six or seven dogs. And absolutely. How does this affect, do you think, the cost of living? Is there any way it affects the cost of living for us?
It's higher.
Why? Why might it be higher?
Because those dog walkers are making all the money.
Oh, the dog walkers. they are making quite a bit.
Those are happy people doing something they love to do.
They are, that's true. And earning a pretty good salary, yeah. That's the plus. We could put some plus pluses. It's not all negative. But for the people who are doing that, I mean, life looks better. You know, and they like the dogs and things like that. But not everybody can afford to have somebody walk their dog. And the fact is, for all the dogs that get walked, there are others that are home alone. Well, I think of one item in the supermarket that I saw once. This one was pre-scrambled eggs. you can buy these things, and they're pre-scrambled, and then you just put them in the microwave for a short period of time, and you had scrambled eggs. And you could save, the whole point with this was that you could save 5 minutes making breakfast by buying pre-scrambled eggs. Now, I looked at the price of the pre-scrambled eggs and realized that they cost about 20 times as much as if you just bought the eggs and did it yourself. And that, in fact, we did a little experiment and looked at the average worker's salary and figured out that it would cost the worker 12 minutes of time at work to buy the eggs that would save 5 minutes of cooking. But we have a lot of things that are going on like this. All right, we've gone on.
I can think of one more.
Okay, one more.
Because of these convenience foods, then we're also losing skills, kitchen skills, cooking skills, right?
We're losing some skills.
Old generation coming up only knows how to put things in the microwave.
And schools are dumping those.
And that doesn't matter if that's all they do. If we don't turn things around, maybe that's that. But okay, so we're losing skills.
And the big grocery stores that are being built, you walk in and there's a huge deli where we've got all these hot foods, and it says, Monday we serve this for dinner and you can buy it and take it home. Tuesday it's this dinner and you can buy it and take it home. In the bigger cities, like Seattle, there's so many markets, so nobody's having to cook. You just buy it and go home.
Yeah. And all the choice, it is interesting too. The average supermarket today has something like 40,000 items for you to choose between. And that takes time to kind of figure that out, go up and down the aisles and pick out all those things. Not to mention all the junk mail that you're sorting through. One of the things I think was one of the I think this is frankly the best thing that the Bush administration has done. And I don't think it did it by itself, but it did do it. How many of you have do not call? I mean, how many people have signed up so that you wouldn't be called by advertisers in the middle of your meal and everything? Lots. Does it work?
No.
No.
It doesn't?
Yes.
Boy, it works for me.
I get called by computer.
If it doesn't work for you, you stand to make a lot of money. Because if they're calling you and you've been and you're on that list. You can take it to court over that, and they will need to pay you. It has worked for many people. I'd like to see a do not, you know, spam and a do not send me so much junk mail and all of those kind of things.
You can get on the direct consumer mailing list, and you can get off of it.
You can get off junk mail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really easy to do.
How well does that work?
Really well. It
does.
Takes about 3 months to get off all the lists, but I don't get credit card applications anymore, and I used to get 4 a week. You go online and Google search, I put in like get consumer mailing list or something, if they want you to look it off, and it'll show you where to go, and you have to log out and log back on each time for every person in your household because they give each one a number. Or for $5, you can do it online, but it's free except for the stamp that you mail it in. It was funny because I did it, I got off, I got back on, I did it again, and my husband's number was like 15 higher than mine. So in that time, 15 other people have done it. But it's made a huge difference in my junk mail.
And on the do not call list, you have to re-sign up for it, I think every 2 or 3 years.
Is that true?
If you've been on the list, if you signed up right when it came out, you need to recall and tell them that once again you want to be put back on. Is it run your time on the list runs out?
Because obviously you might have changed your mind, and that's
exactly.
What you put that in there for.
Yes. Well, maybe you want vital sightings.
What a benefit, huh?
You want vital sightings. So.
After you got so depressed because you weren't exactly. getting all those calls at mealtime. And you felt lonesome.
Lonely.
Yeah. You felt really lonely without the marketers.
That's sufficient.
Calling you up. Okay, well, I want to try something a little different now. I want you to be the devil's advocate because I guess it's appropriate at Holden to preach to the choir. But we do have something of a choir situation, I find, in these things. And it's not necessarily a bad thing to preach to the choir if we all learn together, and then we can go out and talk to people about these things who aren't necessarily in the choir. But I want you to kind of get out of the choir for a little bit and play devil's advocate and kind of take the other side, and I want to see how many arguments you can come up with for why we have to do things the way we're doing them, why we need to work so much, why we need to schedule so much. And I want to start first with you as an individual, as a person, saying, you know, why? I assume none of you do this, you know, overwork or do any of this kind of thing. So this is purely devil's advocate. We know that anybody who is making a statement here is not talking personally. And so you're all absolved of that. But I'd love to just hear what do people say? I mean, how would you justify doing things the way we do them?
Well, I'm an inner city minority single mom with three kids, and I'm trying to get off of welfare to work, you know. So I'm going to school, I'm taking classes, and I'm working two part-time jobs, and, you know, I don't have time for breathing.
You know? Okay, so in your case, very much, you can't afford to do
that's
anything.
That's reality,
you
yeah.
Can't,
I
it's
can't
reality.
Afford it.
Okay, can't afford to work less. Real true for many people. Not for everybody, but...
Just go ahead and shout
them out. This
you
is
you can't afford to, or you don't have the option. If you won't get a job, let's say you won't get a meal or something, you know? Sometimes they
uh-huh.
have mandatory overtime at those kinds of jobs.
Okay, mandatory overtime.
Keep
required.
Up with your neighbors.
Mandatory overtime, no choice. No choice to reduce hours.
Benefits?
You lose your benefits, okay? That's one we hear from a lot. I talked to a couple weeks from now, the Ballingers will be coming up here. Some of you probably know them from Wenatchee. Susan does the nature hikes and so forth here. And Paul is works in a medical clinic in Wenatchee. And Paul told me that that oftentimes 80% of the physical complaints that people have who come into his clinic are the direct result of things like stress, overwork, all these kind of things. But when you say, "Hey, you're kind of killing yourself. You need to cut back on work," people will say, "Well, doc, there's a little problem with that because." You know, my job requires that, and if I don't do it, then I lose my health insurance and I can't see you. So it's kind of a catch-22 situation. For people, a loss of benefits is a real issue.
I want my kids not to miss out on anything.
Don't want kids to miss out. Big one. The other kids are doing it.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
If I don't work a lot, then... my colleagues are going to have to do it, and so we all have to carry our fair share and just, you know, suck it up.
So you don't want to be seen by your colleagues as a slacker, but
that's
you
right.
also feel for them.
Right.
Okay, so you feel for colleagues.
Having a busy schedule makes me feel needed. It makes me feel like my job is really important.
Oh, it makes me feel
yeah.
important. Big one, okay.
A negative is ruins relationships, but in some fields, like education, you can build relationships. You're staying late at night to talk to this kid. You do it because it's purposeful.
Okay.
So.
I think what we're looking at in all of these things is ultimately trying to find balance. It's not saying there is, you know, one way is going to be right for everybody, but that we want to try to find some kind of balance.
The commercial has convinced me that I need this product.
Okay. So I need to buy. And what's the corollary of that often for people? What happens when they buy so much? They get into debt. I'm in debt.
Is that argument for though?
And people will say, "Well, I need to."
Oh, for
overtime is voluntary in my place, but I need to take it because I've got those credit card debts.
What else would I do with my time?
Whoa, big one! Who said that?
I did.
Up there, okay. Hard to see you. Okay, what else would I do? This is a real big one. What else? Oops, I gotta learn how to spell here. I learn how to spell.
The other part of that is not knowing what you would have to deal with, or that you would have to. I mean, we're so busy that there. You have to realize that there are these big holes in your life, whether they're spiritual holes or they're relationship holes, and so. It's
scary.
Scary.
Time is scary. Okay, it's scary. Very very true for many people. We've yes.
What about just the general social structure? If you're in a community or your family structure, everyone is doing the same thing, and you know, you decide to change. Well, you may be the only one in your, you know, your group or your tiny town or your family.
You don't want to stand out. Okay.
I don't have kids, so I feel an obligation to volunteer more, to help people who do have kids have more free time with their kids.
Okay, so there are these kind of things where it's just. You kind of feel. You feel that you need to give. To volunteer. That's right. There are lots of reasons that are very, very valid reasons. It's not. Yes.
Then a macro argument instead of a personal argument is there's a tremendous amount of innovation with all these quick cycle times and people working late. I mean, there's.
Okay. We're going to take the employers. Point of view, and that's
this is kind of
the personal for people, but we will
career advancement
depends on it. Yep.
Community. But just that I really like what I'm doing.
Okay, big one. I like it. I hear that from a lot of people. I mean, it's very true. People might be in a very creative, entertaining kind of work, and so they say, "Well, I'm going to do all this sort of stuff," and they say, "I love it." So what's the problem? So, well, maybe none, but you may find out 20 years from now that you missed out on some other things that might be very important to you, that you never knew your kids, or you never had a family life, or things, and then suddenly maybe you don't like it as much, or you suddenly get laid off, and that happens in our society. So even if you like things a lot, there's some reason to think about, you know, is it so good for me to keep doing this all the time?
If I didn't do it, nobody else would.
Ah, nobody else would do it. Okay. This is my big excuse. I take a campaign on this kind of issue because I think, well, nobody else will do it. And the problem then, too, is if you keep doing it more and more, then nobody thinks they need to do it, so it's...
Or no one else can do it as well as
yeah.
I can.
Nobody else can do it as well. Nobody else would do it, could do it.
All those are, like, you can branch off into a lot of those with where it comes back to self-worth. That sounds a lot like a self-worth issue where you really need, it's like a, there's really an underlying problem and you use that as a self-worth tool.
All right.
And that's the big one I think about whenever I think about my own self-esteem or whatever.
I wouldn't feel important?
That goes hand in hand with the whole crisis management. Folks need a crisis so they can feel valued. So, I mean, I just think there's a huge conversation in that alone.
Yeah, but sometimes it's more that you really may be the most skilled, but
yeah.
You know, if you continue to do it, no one else builds those skills.
That's a good point. And then nobody else learns these kind of things. Let's try and if you have others, feel free to break in on the as we look at that other side, the kind of the employer, the business person, the politician, the person who was defending the status quo against. Let me give you a quick example. We had a campaign in Washington State this past spring in our legislature in which we tried to get a 5-week paid childbirth leave law passed so that mothers and fathers in Washington State would be able to take up to 5 weeks of leave when a child was born paid, and they would receive $250 per week, or a total of $1,250 for this time. And one of the reasons that we wanted to do this was because there are many, many poorer folks who can't really take advantage of the Family Medical Leave Act, who really can't take the time off without at least some kind of compensation. We thought this was a pretty modest proposal. It wasn't going to cost business anything, in fact. But nonetheless, it went down in flames. And there were lots of reasons given for why we can't do this kind of thing. So that's just one example. But generally, if we want to maybe change public policy, or if we want to change policy in our own workplace, or if we want to talk to the boss about cutting back and doing some kind of things, what are the responses we might hear? Why we can't change the status quo? Let's just fire away with a few of.
Won't be competitive with other.
We can't be competitive, okay?
The customers demand 24-hour.
Customers, okay. The customer demands 24/7.
If I let you do it, everyone else will want to do it too.
If I let you do it, right.
Ultimately, I'm sure the argument is the price of the end consumer good goes up.
Prices will go up, and that's of course tied to can't be competitive. Our prices will go up, and therefore
profits go down.
Yeah, bottom line goes down.
Profit goes down.
With your paid family leave thing?
Yes.
I would imagine an argument would be if you can't afford to have kids, then don't have them.
I'll say that's a big argument.
But you know what I mean? People think that. There's people out there that think that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, very much so. And that was certainly one of the arguments.
Why should I pay for you to have kids, or what, you know, why should my taxes go up?
That next one. Taxes will go up.
Well, it's just the same thoughts of, you know, promoting people to have children in welfare or out of wedlock, and how immoral is that?
Okay, it's promoting immorality. Big one. This has always been a big one. In the 19th century, was always if we don't have those people working 6 days a week and 12 or 14 hours a day, what do? They'll drink. I mean, you know, it's promoting immorality. Morality demands that people be nose to the grindstone. What other things might a business person or a politician say?
Shareholders.
Pardon?
Shareholders.
What about?
You have to please the shareholders by constantly increasing return on investment. Stock
right.
Options.
We'll lose investors because
the value of your stock would go down if your company.
Okay. Yeah. Stock value decline.
If you don't take the job, then somebody else will.
If
you don't work the hours, then somebody else will.
Yeah. How will that be? How will that be used in this?
Well. I'm only going to hire somebody that will do this. You can find another job that doesn't work as well.
Okay, yeah, go somewhere else. Right.
Well, it costs less money to hire one person to work over the hours they're supposed to work than hiring two people to work the hours that are there.
Because of?
Health insurance.
Benefits.
Yeah. Benefits.
Okay, cost and benefits on both sides. The employer says benefit costs are going to go up for me. I've got to give health care or something like that to two people instead of one. And on the other hand, you say, wow, if I don't do this, I will lose my benefits because many of those benefits, and especially health care in this country, are tied to the job.
Increasingly, though, that's not true, that they are hiring more people at less than full time.
Right.
Which means that this lady down here has to work two jobs.
Right.
Benefits.
So they're hiring people without benefits. Right. And one of the things we will talk about in another session is what some of the counter arguments are. Do people say, well, it's just a choice. Everybody gets to choose it. They can choose as many hours as they want or don't want. Have you heard that?
Not when there are budget cuts and they ask you to take on another person's role.
Right.
And that is another
thing. They are downsizing, and so they need you to do this.
You're not being a team player.
Oh, you're not a team player. Here's a good little story for you. I like telling this one because last year I was in the Netherlands, and I was at the University of Amsterdam, and I was speaking with a Dutch professor who studies these issues of time and work and work-life balance in different countries. And I asked him to tell me a little bit about what he'd found out. And he said, well, he had just come away from this fascinating interview with a fellow who was a manager of Hewlett-Packard's Dutch operations, and American companies invest a great deal in the Netherlands. One of those little known facts is that we actually invest about three times as much money each year in Holland as we do in China. But that story doesn't really come out. So this guy had come over from the States 2 years earlier to be a manager at Hewlett-Packard. He was an American, and the Dutch professor said, so have you noticed any difference between how work-life balance operates in this country compared to the United States? And the American guy said, oh, I found out about that my first day on the job. So yeah, well, what happened? Not my first day, my first week on the job. Oh yeah, what happened? He said, well, it was Friday evening, about 8 o'clock at night, and we had a shipment of stuff that I really wanted to get out early on Monday morning. So I called my secretary at home, and I said, I need you to email so-and-so and call so-and-so and do this, this, and this so we can get this shipment of stuff out right away on Monday morning. And what happened then? So, well, the secretary said, well, excuse me, sir, but I don't normally work after 5 o'clock on Friday. It's my weekend, and I don't normally expect to be called at home during my time off work. And the new American manager was a bit surprised by this, and he said, well, excuse me, but I'm the new manager here, and we're a company that competes in the global economy, And we have a big shipment of stuff that really needs to get out there. This has to get done. And we're a company that really appreciates employees who are team players. So what happened next? Well, the secretary became a bit more demure and said, well, all right, sir, I'll do what you ask of me. He said, but I need to remind you of a couple of things. Yeah, what's that? What's that? He says, well, first of all, you'll have to pay me double time for this, because under Dutch law, any work performed between 5 p.m. on Friday and 7 a.m. on Monday that is either overtime or unscheduled is double time. She says, now, I must say, I can use the money, and I didn't really have any big plans this weekend, so I will do what you ask, but there's another consideration. She says, you know, sir, I'm really a team player. And she says, if I call this person and that person and email this person, do you think they're going to, what do you think they're going to do? They're just going to yell at me. They're not going to get it, because they're expecting to have their weekend and their time with their family as well. She says, so what I'd suggest is that you cool your jets, and we'll come in on Monday morning. We'll work real hard for you, and we'll get this shit out. It's going to be okay. Just relax. Secretary says this to the boss. So what did you do? The professor asked the boss, and the boss says, well, I said, forget it then, and I hung up the phone in frustration, and I stewed all weekend. And then what happened? Well, they came in on Monday morning, and they worked real hard, and they got the shipment out, and, you know, it's kind of gone like that for the 2 years that I've been here, you know. It just seems to work, and he says, and the best part about it is now even I have a life. The boss. Now even the boss has a life. So this is just but we hear this, you know, you got to be a team, we've got to do all these kind of things. We've got to do all these things to be competitive, et cetera. But everybody isn't looking at it that way. So what are some of the other arguments that a politician might make about some of these changes?
It's going to hurt our economy.
Hurt our economy. This is, you know, overwork is what makes America strong. We've heard that. Remember the there was a story once where George Bush, this was during the campaign, and there was a woman in a situation like yours who talked to him and said, well, sir, you know, I'm working three jobs to make ends meet. And anybody hear this story and remember what the president's response was?
Good for you or something.
Like, yeah, you're a hero. I mean, three jobs. Look at this. This woman's working three jobs. Isn't she wonderful? You know, what an example for the rest of the country. Okay. What I want to do now, we're going to try to talk a little bit at some point about some answers to some of these kinds of objections. And in the next session, we're going to talk about kind of some of the things that we can do about the personal side to this. How, if we want to, can we both maybe change the situations at work, but also change the situations at home and with the overscheduling and deal with some of those kinds of things. So I want to talk about that. And then in the final session, I want to talk more about what we can do as a society and how we can change our public policy. But before that, what I want to do now is show a little video, and when it's done, we'll probably there'll be about 10 or 15 minutes left before Vespers, so we'll just call a halt to things then, unless anybody has one or two questions. But this is a little look at history, kind of how we got where we are today, and because one of the things that's often said is that it's always been like this, and you know, and people have always done these kind of things, and in fact it may be rough, but you know, we're so much better off than previous societies were. So this kind of looks at that question. You will see when it starts, pull this down, that the host, Scott Simon, this is from my film Running Out of Time, you'll see that the host, Scott Simon, has a couple of band-aids on his face, and that they will be very confusing to you, not having seen what came before. But what came before is that Scott was giving some humorous tips to people about how to save time, and one of his tips was that you could save a minute every day by shaving with two razors instead of one. So, you know, he's got a better idea. So, you may want to turn the lights on.
Are we moderates? As in the United States and Japan, are working longer hours but enjoying it less. On the other hand, the people who worked in the farms and the fields and the factories a century and more ago worked even longer and harder hours. Whatever our complaints, we still have more free time than any other people in history, don't we?
The Manchibenga struck me as being people who always have enough time. They're never in a hurry.
Anthropologist Alan Johnson still remembers wistfully 2 years he spent with the Manchibenga. Peruvian rainforest drive.
It's just a pleasure to be around the Manchibenga. They're working. They're calm, they're physically comfortable, and there's the sense of them enjoying it the way we might enjoy a hobby, a craft. No time pressure.
Contrary to popular wisdom, so-called primitive societies frequently enjoy more free time than we do. Anthropologists say that such societies are able to meet their need for food, clothing, and shelter in just a few hours a day. The rest of their time devoted to socializing and other leisure activities.
The Manchibenga certainly are able to meet all of their needs in 6 to 8 hours of work. And that leaves a lot of time.
Alan Johnson found it hard to leave the tranquil world of the Manchibenga and return home.
And it was a very strange feeling. Here I was walking in West Los Angeles down the street, and I was in a kind of time warp where everybody around me was moving extremely fast. Sort of like a surrealistic scene from a movie or something, where I was just really slow and really comfortable, and all around me people were hurrying and scurrying.
Classical Western civilization shared the belief that leisure was important to develop a community and to foster an understanding of life.
For the Greeks, no doubt, work is for being free and doing the arts of freedom, liberal arts, writing, speaking, conversation.
An expert on classical philosophy, Dr. Benjamin Honeycutt, teaches leisure studies. He works hard at it, but not always long, often leaving campus early to spend time with his children.
Sweet Lord, sweet chariot, coming for carry home. I think that work has become a modern religion. We answer the traditional religious questions. Who am I? Where am I going? What does it all mean for me? What must I do to be saved? All of these traditional religious questions are now all answered increasingly with work.
Ben Honeycutt believes that we've turned the wisdom of antiquity upside down, wrong side up.
Before the 20th century, work was a means to an end. The 20th century has reversed that, and work becomes an end in itself. And consequently, leisure is transformed. Instead of being the purpose of work, I'm working for something better. The transformation, the metamorphosis occurs. There's nothing better. Leisure, then, is important only in service to work. It's trivialized. It amounts to laying in the hammock or collapsing in front of the television set. All of the active components, the community involvement, the time spent with children, for example. All of those things are made less important by virtue of the importance, the exploding importance of work.
Even serfs in the Middle Ages toiled less than we do. Experts estimate that an average workday in medieval Europe was 9 or 10 hours long, longer in summer, shorter in winter. However, agricultural labor was often performed at a leisurely pace, and it was abandoned entirely during scores of holy days. At the beginning of the Renaissance, religious holidays in some parts of Europe amounted to more than 150 a year. But in Benedictine creating monasteries like this one in England, a new ideology, glorifying work and demanding strict observation of time, had already taken root. To work is to pray, said St. Benedict. Idleness is the enemy of the soul. Therefore, at fixed times, he said, the brothers ought to be occupied in manual labor, and again at fixed times, in sacred reading. Benedict said that even bodily functions had to be performed at certain scheduled set times. So if you were a medieval monk, if you had to go, you had to wait. Till when? Till a bell, or in the late Middle Ages, a new invention called the clock proclaimed the appointed hour.
When you go to any medieval town now, you see that town clock. It became the centerpiece for a new way of organizing society. And once you could organize people by putting them on regular hours and minutes, you could get them into an industrial frame of mind, which requires standardization, optimization of time, predictability of outcomes. That all goes in an industrial frame of mind.
In the more competitive world of trade and commerce that followed the Renaissance, time became money. Manufacturers began seeking ways to produce their wares more quickly. Here at England's famous Wedgwood Pottery Factory, one of the first assembly lines was developed in the 18th century. The process still operates in much the same manner today, with each craft person down the line performing a specific task, a time-saving measure. The Industrial Revolution made it possible to turn out textiles and other goods in a fraction of the time that was formerly required. Benjamin Franklin marveled at the efficiency of the new machines.
If every man and woman would work for 4 hours each day on something useful, that labor would procure all the necessaries and comforts of life.
4 hours. During the 19th century, many factory owners forced their employees to work 14 hours a day instead.
This new building behind me was built in 1806 by a man called Benjamin Gott. He was a local merchant. Benjamin Gott was probably a little in advance of his time. He certainly was a very progressive person. And he laid down some rules when he put his mill in. One that he didn't want to employ children who were younger than 10 years old. And no child would work longer than 16 hours in a day.
Not only were hours longer, most holidays were abolished. Only on Sundays were the workers free.
And people look at that period of time and they say, wow, we've had tremendous progress since then. We're down to a 40-hour week, roughly speaking. And look at all the great things that our economic system has brought us. Not only has it made us wealthier, but it's also given us a lot more free time. What they forget is that if you look just a little bit farther back in history, the 18th and 19th centuries were absolutely unusual because they were a period in which working hours had already roughly doubled.
From the beginning, workers resisted these new demands for their time. Short of their old religious holidays, they invented a new one, St. Monday. After a Sunday night in a bar like this one,
Monday they would wake up with a hangover and come in late. And that was often known as the privilege of St. Monday. It was a way of having Monday morning at least off.
We have meat.
So let's see the lights. So the, you can see that, you know, this is how we've looked at time and how much we work has changed a great deal throughout history, and hopefully we may be on the verge of rethinking some of those things and changing some of them. This year, the event we call Take Back Your Time Day, which falls each year on October 24th, will take place on a Monday. And so we will be encouraging some people to actually celebrate St. Monday. And coming late or not coming in at all, and let people know that we've got to begin to turn this around. Billy Bragg actually has a song called St. Monday about celebrating this. But This was probably one of the most unfortunate parts of the Reformation was that with no saints, there were no saints days. So, if the Catholics get on us Protestants about this, they may have some validity in all of this. And I don't know how we can restore this. I don't necessarily we need to go back to the saints' days, but we need to think about how we can give ourselves some more time to live. Tomorrow we'll talk about personal things and try to bring in all of the ideas of people here and some of the things that I've learned in talking with people around the country about what's happening in various communities and with various people. Then I also encourage you to come to the forum tomorrow night, which Renita is going to be running as we look at questions about happiness and what makes people happy. And that'll have a lot to do with our final discussion as well. So thank you all for your time.